Building connections in the workplace is vital for the health of your organization. And doing it, it's not always easy, and it really depends on the organization's culture. Now imagine trying to build those connections in an organization that's hierarchical and traditionally not very progressive. That's the challenge our guest had today, and he's got some really interesting tactics and suggestions that may just work for your organization. Hold on. This is Relationships at Work, the Employee Experience and Workplace Culture Podcast. And that's me using my radio voice. My name's Russell Oliker. Thank you so much for joining us. One of my favorite things about doing this, about putting myself out there with this podcast, is talking to people. I just talked to a person that I've known, oh my goodness, for years and years and years online. And we're talking about her being a possible guest on the podcast. Never talked in person, never had that one-on-one time. I mean, sure enough, we talked virtually, but still there was never that connection because we just sort of orbited each other. We were on the same social networks. We knew a lot of the same people. We live in the same town. But this podcast has allowed me that gateway, that opportunity to actually talk to people that I probably should have gotten the courage to talk to years ago. And one of those other benefits is talking to you. And I would love for you to connect with the podcast, with me, kind of the same thing. Go over to LinkedIn. We have a Relationships at Work podcast page. It's sort of done like a business page, but it's where I'm sharing a lot of the episodes, great articles from previous guests, some ideas, some suggestions around employee experience and workplace culture. But where better to do all that than on the social platform that's about the workplace, about work, which is LinkedIn. So I hope you join me over there. I'd love to engage and even just hear about your stories and what you're going through and things you're curious about that you'd like to help in changing how we do this thing we call work. We all have to do it. Wouldn't it be nicer if it was just a little bit better? And that's the goal for all of us, including my guest today on the podcast, Police Chief Chris Shung. Now, Russell, how'd you meet a police chief? You didn't do anything wrong, did you? I'm so glad you asked. Yes, but not for the purposes of this podcast. I was on a panel for a group at the Social Media Marketing Institute over in Ireland. I was invited to do a very, very early for me panel on relationship building and public trust. And I was sharing the panel with Chris. We'd never met each other. But yet our presentations were so in sync with each other. They just fed off each other and really tied into the same values, tactics, and approaches that has been pretty successful for both of us. So we hit it off. And great guy. Really happy to keep that relationship going and have him on a podcast called Relationships at Work. Now, Chris is definitely not who you'd maybe think of an atypical police chief. Now, I'm being very general here. I'm being very stereotypical, but Chris has an approach, and I really like how he's doing this with his department, his police department in California. And he's got some things about building connection, some things about building bridges internally in his organization that I think could be applied to any organization. And I think you will too. Let's get to it. And on the show today, we have Chris Shung, and here is why he is awesome. He's the police chief of the Mountain View Police Department. That's a city in California, for those who don't know. He's been with them for more than 20 years, rising up the ranks. Formerly a member of the Leadership Council for Government Social Media, member of the Board of Directors for the Peninsula Conflict Resolution Center, frequent speaker, frequent writer on engagement, and that's actually how we met him, which was, interestingly enough, a Canadian and American on a panel about digital engagement in Ireland. But he's here with us now. Hi, Chris.
Hey, Russell. Great to see you.
First question, gotta ask it, can't get around it, which is, what's your best or worst employee experience?
Let's see. I'm gonna go with worst. And this was as a brand new officer. We were working downtown, and I had a sergeant at the time who basically ordered me to cite some jaywalkers, right? And wanted to make a point. And up to this point, you know, we practiced a lot of discretion, but it was one of these like letter of the law. And the poor couple that I stopped, they couldn't understand why they were getting a ticket either. I couldn't even understand it, but it's one of those like rank things where it's like, no, I'm ordering you to write them a ticket because technically by letter of the law, they did jaywalk. And just that experience, and I was probably 1 year on, I think that cemented in my mind what I will never do for the rest of my career. And the purpose of laws and everything is for people to understand. It's not to, hit them on the head with it. So, very kind of burned into my memory was that experience. And moving forward, I was much more into compassionate policing as opposed to just enforcement.
That was decades ago. You're the police chief now. That was impactful to be that long ago. And when I asked you the question, that was one of the that came, that was in the chamber. That was ready to go.
It was. Yeah, it seared into my memory. I can see their face of the couple to this day, and they're just wondering why are you citing me? And I'm like, I'm sorry, you broke the law, right? And legally, or they're required to get, they're not required to, but I was under orders, and that, as I rose through the ranks, was continually in the back of my mind. Like, people need to understand. I'm talking about people internally in the department need to understand why they're carrying out an order. And if they don't understand it and they can't get behind it, there's something wrong there.
And I mean, this podcast is called Relationships at Work, and it is very much about employees, but you're looking at a customer, more or less. I mean, it's your community, and it's really hurting the relationship or any potential relationship that organization may have with those there to serve and protect, may get that impression. So, yeah, yeah, fair. And I'm interesting that it seared on your brain. Anyway, that's going to bother me for a while. So, thank you for sharing that. We're talking about communications today, internal communications, which again, all about relationships. So for you, I wanted to kind of first cover what do we mean when we talk internal communications?
Well, I think most people would default to these are the emails that I send from my golden tower in my office or whatever. Not the case, or not the way I see that. Internal communications to me is how effective we are communicating anything up and down the organization, right? And if you play that telephone game, how effective is it that do you actually have the same message or story or whatever by the time it reaches its endpoint? Even more importantly, do people internally understand the why behind decisions as opposed to they're reading an email that lacks context and lacks background on how a decision was made?
What are the different ways you internally, I mean, you're the top of the pyramid. So how do you communicate to your officers, to your organization?
There is the formal chain of command where you will have an email that goes out to every employee from the office of the chief. Anecdotally, I think that's probably about 20% effective. Maybe 20% of people might open that email and never understand it. These emails are read in briefing and things like that. But more effective in my mind is we actually employ a newsletter that is mobile optimized for smartphones. And it's very short and sweet. And what I've found is I don't write as a chief when I write that newsletter. I write as Chris, and I talk about things that are on my mind, that I see in the industry about leadership. And what I've found is voice and tone cut through the kind of bureaucratic layers of an organization. And through that newsletter, we can actually see through the metrics behind the scenes. We can't see who's opened it or what, but we can see at about a 90%+ open rate. And it's been
Wow.
consistently like that for almost a year now. And I'm gonna have to confess, I'm gonna fall on the sword here and embarrass myself. In high school, I was on the yearbook committee. Okay, so as a pseudo wannabe journalist yearbook guy, I was always, very attuned to images, captions, a quick byline story, and that's basically what that newsletter is. It's short and sweet. It gets information across. It's not perfect, but I think it really goes a long way in improving communications.
I mean, you're talking stories, you're talking about leadership. So I'm assuming your newsletter isn't, "Hey, I'm the boss. Guess what I did this week?" Like, what is in the newsletter itself that is warranting such interest?
I'll pick whatever might either be in the public, in the media. It could be trending. The most recent one we did, I had a quote that I came across that had Robin Williams, And the quote was about, you know, you never know the battles that people are facing that you might meet. And I wrote a short paragraph about, you know, let's remember that externally and internally, that those in the public that we meet are facing battles that we will know nothing about. And so when we're meeting them at a point in time, we need to have some compassion and understanding that their emotional response to us could be for another reason. And then I make the connection internally as we walk the hallways with our fellow teammates. It's more than likely that we're all fighting our own battles, right? Whether it's parental stress, whether it's marriage stress, stress, right? And so I think we're all phenomenal at putting on that mask and that armor when we show up in the workplace and we pretend that everything's fine. But in reality, you know, the culture here in Mountain View is just assume that everyone's kind of dealing with something and give each other a little bit of grace. And that was just the topic of the last newsletter, right? And I think it gives me a voice in a different way. And I like to try to break through this hierarchical org chart, right? I've always been a little bit counter to that. You know, when I say that I have an open door policy, in that newsletter, I actually issued like a challenge. Hey, there's a chess game. There's a chessboard in my office. You are all free to come in and make a move, and I will try what I can to play against you. And you know, a couple officers took me up on it. It was fun. It's just a different way to go beyond just saying I have an open door policy. It's like, no, come on in. Let's just talk to me as Chris, as opposed to the rank, the chief, and all that stuff.
You mentioned hierarchy, and I really want to kind of get into that, because building bridges is something internal communications can do. Building relationships, building networks, if it's done well, but hierarchies can really get in the way of that. Specifically, I've heard of organizations where you can't even talk. If you're a certain level, you can't talk to another certain level because you're not on the same org chart level they are.
Right.
What do you do to combat that?
So here's an interesting idea. I learned this from a couple different chiefs over in Colorado. So they started a book club. And, you know, you go and you learn together. And so we tried one out. We're on our second book now. The first book we did was Simon Sinek's Infinite Game. So here's the ground rules. And when I tell you the ground rules, I want you to listen for what this does to that hierarchy you're talking about. Ground rules is this. There's no rank in the room. There's actually like a swear jar, but it's equivalent. It's a rank jar. If you address anyone in the room by rank, you got to put a virtual dollar in there, right? There's no seniority in the room. There are no roles. You know, in police departments, you have sworn officers and then you have support staff. So naturally, you're going to have a little bit of division, right? Much like in private sector, you're going to have management and non-management or whatever. And so another ground rule is there's no titles in the room. There's no rank, no seniority, no roles, first name only. And we are here to learn together. And when you create that opportunity like that, a lot of magic happens. It breaks down because you're going to interact with the same people in the book club later on in a different manner, in an official manner, but you're going to have a layer of trust and communication that you didn't have before. Because in the book club, we're kind of vulnerable, right? We talk about what we've learned. We talk about our failures, where we've fallen down. And now we've moved on to Brené Brown's Dare to Lead. So, you know, you take those two books, incredible authors, and you're just on this journey together. And then a month later, you find yourself in a different, you know, official meeting. There's a little something extra there. And I'm trying to just build on that to really break down the hierarchical layers that you know, prevent just great communication.
It's funny. So you're breaking down hierarchical stigmas by removing the workplace.
Kind of. Yeah, you could, I guess you could say that.
By taking people out of it, because there's a lot of, especially new people coming in. How do you get to them? Because I don't know, are you inviting anybody at every level into the book club, or is there some onboarding challenges? Because yeah. I know somebody coming into an organization immediately will be intimidated by about four levels above them.
Sure. Yeah. Everyone's invited to the book club, but to answer your question on onboarding. So when we hire a police officer, first thing they do is they go to the police academy, and that setting in the police academy, they join maybe up to 60 to 80 other cadets that just get yelled at doing pushups all the time. Everything is about rank. Everything is about structure. So we try to push against that because we're Mountain View. So what we do is very strategically, within about the first month and a half, I'll come in and I'll bring our recruits, the ones that are representing Mountain View. I'm bringing them lunch. And I sit down and the first thing I tell them is, don't look at the title. Don't look at the stars. This is Chris. I'm checking in on you. How are you doing? How's your family? Are you having enough time at home outside of shining your boots? Are you taking care of your family? Because in Mountain View, family comes first. The career and the job comes second. And we believe wholeheartedly that if things are good at home, things are generally good at work. But things are stressful at home, it's going to manifest in work. So I sit down and I make it okay for them to just relax and know that we care for them. And then a month or two later, a captain will come and do the same thing. No rank, just how's it going? We're going to treat you to lunch. It begins there. And they're assigned a formal mentor. They're also assigned an informal mentor from a prior academy class that just kind of checks in, shares their experience, right? Because you're right, onboarding is so important to keep that consistent. Is it perfect? Are we perfect? Absolutely not. But we're constantly trying to figure out different ways to push against the way the system has been to date.
How do you get other managers, senior leaders, to get buy-in? Because they may have come from other organizations that did not do that, right, that did not approach things like that. So how do you get their buy-in?
Well, this is where the rank is kind of handy. You know, when you are at the top, you can force that. But I will back up a little bit. I don't know if you've heard of Simon Sinek's Law of Diffusion of Innovation. He didn't create it, but he talks about it. It's a quick Google search on a YouTube video, and you'll see it. It's like 3 minutes long. But he talks about if you want to make change, you don't try to change the center of that bell curve, the masses. You actually focus your efforts on the front, the innovators and the early adopters, which is about the first 12.5% of people. So proof of concept, we've done this on a bunch of different ideas where you try to effect change. And sure enough, you get about that front, curve part of people who are interested and willing to go, you know what, I want to try a little bit. I want to learn a little bit more about that. And they do. And before you know it, the people in the middle of the bell curve start to look over their shoulder and go, you know what, that seems pretty cool. And it seems more acceptable now because others have gone before me.
How do you get into the personalization of it? Because everybody's different. So to come at a new or even a mid-level career person in the organization, and you have this, say, a book club. Well, there's a lot of introverts that will never show up at that book club just because it's a different energy that they're not used to. So how do you cater to a different type of people to make them feel a little bit more inclusive when you're building those bridges?
You know, I think it's creating the expectations for leadership that we do everything we can to create psychologically safe teams, meaning you have the freedom to fail. You have the freedom to admit that you don't know the answer. You have the freedom to be yourself. And we've often said, and we'll use this analogy that a prior chief used to use. He goes, if I got to pick a landmark that we both know, if we're going to go to Yellowstone, right? Sorry, you're in Canada.
Sure, I've heard of that.
We're going to go to Yellowstone and I'm looking on a map. My mission to you as the leader to the subordinate is take me to Yellowstone, but I'm not going to dictate how you get me there. Right. But if I see on the map that you're going the wrong way, I'm going to kind of raise my hand and go, hey. And the takeaway from all of this is people are encouraged to find solutions their own way. Maybe they're introverts, maybe they're extroverts, maybe they have this talent, maybe they have another talent. But what they should always have is the knowledge that the rank above them, or the rank of two ranks above them, supports them. And it's their safety net to enable them to get empowered. You know, and I say all this and it sounds great, but you know, in reality, it's not, we're not perfect, right? I can think of so many often, times sitting where I sit, it's like, oh, I wish this was uniformly pushed through the organization. It's not, but I'm going to keep trying, because I think that's the role of leadership, is to set that beacon out there and go, this is the direction we're going. And, some were kind of dragging, kicking and screaming to this kind of new culture. And many others are just like, yeah, we like this and we want more of it.
What are some red flags? I mean, do you come into an organization? I mean, you've been with this one organization for a very long time. Mm-hmm. And as you move up and get to, I'm at the top now where I can make actual change. How do you know you need to make change?
You know, I think I was very fortunate that the chief before me and the chief before him were both pretty progressive. Right. So even talking 15 plus years ago, when I was beginning to get my first promotions, I was promoted with examples of progressive thinking. You know, I would always hear things in meetings like, okay, we're not going to skate to where the, I'm going to use a Canadian sports reference here. We're going to skate to where the puck is going, not where, you know, okay. So I figured you would get
that
one. It's
a Wayne Gretzky quote. You are quoting Wayne Gretzky.
Okay.
But no, I'm loving it. I'm eating it up. I'm here for it. Go.
Okay. So that type of cultural leadership, right? And you know, it enables that. And so I think I had the fortune of being raised in a leadership culture that was more open to change. But then if I dial it back and look at the industry, like if I would go to a conference that that was an international conference of police, they have International Association of Chiefs of Police, right? Then I started to realize that, you know, some of the things we're doing in Mountain View are a little bit on the edge or the bleeding edge, or, you know, and that actually is what kind of started our journey down speaking at a lot of conferences, is we figured out that a lot of the things we try are like, oh, you know, you get a lot of people going, we like that. We want more of that.
And how do you know it's working?
You know, it's validation. I will tell you, when you're at the front edge of something, it's a very terrifying feeling because you don't have anything to compare it against. And you don't know, you know, I'm not a big data guy. And so I kind of go more by like anecdotally, like looking around going, does this work, right? And so for us, a lot of it was our approach to social media, where 10 years ago when we jumped into this, concepts like using sense of humor or changing our voice and tone to not sound like government was so foreign back then. And then as we shared that and we shared what we saw were communities latching on and wanting more of that, and then you start to see it replicated by the people that you're kind of sharing this with, and you go to different conferences, right? And you talk about it more and more, and you're like, that's validation that we are onto something. Now, I'm not here to say we invented that. I'm just saying that, you know, we had the right tools in place to allow me to make those mistakes because my bosses at the time let me and create that environment, right? So to me, it's a lot of different things that kind of make that perfect recipe for innovation.
This is definitely about employees. So I want to talk about what you're talking about, which is the outreach, the digital engagement. Because what I don't think a lot of people realize, and I speak on this a bit too, is the benefit to employees by being so forward, by being so engaging, by seeing the value of their work in a public sphere. The public sees it from the outside looking in, going, oh, good, they're engaging, they're customer-centric. But there's that internal validation that people don't see and don't understand, that it actually helps your culture by feeling like what you do matters.
Yeah, the most interesting kind of takeaway I've had before is you start to think like, why do we as management think that the employees don't see the things that we're broadcasting externally to our stakeholders, right? It's like, do we think that they're just blind to it? No. And as I started to watch for that, I would see a lot of the content that we would put out be liked or shared by employees or by stakeholders in the community, right? And so to me, it's that's what kind of took us down the road of that internal communications newsletter, is that the same tools that we think about when we want, you know, engagement with the community work internally as well. You can, you know, create culture, you can create little communities within your organization through digital tools by employing the exact same approaches, right? Because if you put boring content internally, guess what? You're going to have no engagement, no followers, no one's hitting like or share, right?
I once had someone at a conference ask me, like, how quickly can my podcast become more, you know, popular and more listeners? How fast does it happen? Does it happen right away? And my first question was, how good's your podcast? It's not about how popular. It's the quality of the content. It's the story you're trying to tell.
Yep.
How have you seen it benefit your organization? Because I mean, I get it from a public standpoint, but I'm from that employee subcultures. How have you seen it benefit?
You know, it's interesting. Like, giving methods of appreciation to employees, right? You could write them a memo and embarrass them in front of their coworkers and say, oh, so-and-so did great, right? And most people, at least in policing culture, it's like they're kind of almost embarrassed. If you write a story about them and brag about them online, about the great work that they do, and that same employee sees their family members and their friends going, wow, that's fantastic, this is awesome, and they're liking and sharing, they're not going to admit it, but you know that makes them feel good. That is validation, because, you know, especially in our line of work, they do, no one that goes into police work really wants the credit or the attention. They just want to know they're making a difference. And that right there is just an example of they're making a difference. And now the family members that they don't typically go home and share this with are seeing that as well.
Where does empowerment fit into all this? Because we're talking about your communications and the newsletter and so forth, but you can't be the only person communicating within the organization to help with that culture. How do you work empowerment to do it?
So another thing that we started was an internal communications committee, right? And this is drawn from a cross-section of the organization. And it's not the first time we've done something like this. During COVID, we actually created an innovation team, same ground rules, no rank, everyone's got ideas. You know, the solution to COVID is somewhere in this group. So this internal communications team is just that. It's made up of people from across the organization. There's no rank. There's, in fact, the first few iterations of people that came on, my only challenge to them as the chief was, okay, for our next meeting, I need you to go bring 2 to 3 people each, kicking and screaming if you have to, because I want to hear from different segments. I don't want to just hear from the ones who've raised their hands and say, I want to, you know, talk to you, right? So it's interesting because, you know, you bring them in figuratively kicking and screaming, but you're going to hear their part of the world, their lens that they see the organization through. And that is what's always been missing as things are filtered up officially through the official channels. But what I found is, like, the more you uncover that, the more there is that I realize as a leader that I don't know. You know, as a leader, you're like, oh, I have this control thing. I need to know as much as I can to make the best decisions. But you know, the employees, the staff, they hold all the info, but you just got to provide and break down the barriers that prevent that. And there's not one thing that does it. If you've taken anything so far from all these stories, is we're like hitting it from all different angles and approaches to encourage as much communication up and down the chain as possible.
One of the things I'm trying to hammer home a lot with my talking about employee engagement is that missing middle. I know that gets used a lot with housing, but that 80-10-10 rule, which is 10% of the rock stars at the top and the 10% are the problem people at the bottom, get most of the attention from the organization, from leadership. It's the 80% in the middle that are doing their jobs that never get an opportunity to talk because they're never pointed to because they don't raise their hand. They're just too busy doing their work. They're setting their boundaries strongly. Right. And it's cracking that down. So I love the idea that you're inviting people to this communication council, but you're also going, now bring in 2 people. Mm-hmm. And hopefully they're voices that you're not hearing all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's almost like a bad pyramid scheme with the right purpose. So
no Ponzi schemes in this communication council.
Exactly.
We're good.
Exactly. Good.
So why is this so hard? Because Chris, I mean, organizations are not great at internal communications. They almost think of it as an afterthought of the, can HR do that? Oh, I know they're doing 17 other things, but can they do that too?
Right.
So just trying to understand, why do you think it's such a hard thing to do?
You know, I think people only see the end product of a decision. They never really get visualization of how the widget is made in the widget factory, right? And so, and I remember being a brand new promoted lieutenant, which for us is the first time you step into the management ranks. Pre-lieutenant, I used to think, you know, oh, I had the answer to everything. It's very simple. And then it comes time for promotion. And the first time as a lieutenant, you sit there and you listen to all the different nuances of what the department needs, short-term, mid-term, long-term, succession planning, all those things. And you come out with a selection of promotions, right? And then you're like, that's probably the best decision. And then that news goes out into the organization. And the first thing you hear is, what in the world are you guys thinking? Right? And so again, that was kind of a defining moment for me too. It's like, you know, with personnel issues, you can never really open it up totally transparently, but for everything else, you probably can. So like one of the things we do is our command staff meetings, which is our leadership team, typically open to management. We open them up now to line level supervisors, especially with Zoom. They can Zoom in and just listen and even contribute to how decisions are made, even benign stuff. Or, you know, to me, it's like, why not take use of that technology? There's nothing secret that we're discussing. And my hope is this: if an officer sees a decision that was made and they go, what in the world were they thinking? The hope is that the line level supervisor happened to Zoom in that day or stop in and go, oh yeah, I was there for that. No, this is what went into that, right? The informal information and context that gets added in And then people walk away kind of figuratively nodding their heads going, okay, that makes sense. And that instills more confidence, that instills better communication, et cetera.
It also is a demonstration of walking the walk when it comes to psychological safety,
right?
Because there will be a lot of frontline staff and a lot of organizations that will not say anything because their boss is on that call. And that might be a career limiting move.
Right.
So having a demonstration of that. Also, what I really like is you're demonstrating that it's not scary to be at the leadership position. Mm-hmm. And for someone that's brand new or somebody that's working their way up, you're giving them a career path of, look, this is what we do. You might be interested in doing this one day.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've learned really early on, you have to model even like, you know, I think the old school way of leadership is I make no mistakes and I have all the information. I'm just a smart guy. I came in totally different. My very first leadership team as a chief, the first thing I said was, okay, folks, we're going to make mistakes. I'm going to make mistakes and we're going to do them together. And then we're going to pick each other up and then we're going to keep going. Right. And so is it weird? Is it a hit on my ego if I'm in a meeting and I tell people, you know what? I messed up. Of course, I'm a human. I don't like that feeling. But then again, now I realize that the burden of leadership is to actually proactively message that and push those concepts down the chain, because that models to the middle managers, to the line level supervisors, that it's actually empowering to your staff when you admit that you're human. Because otherwise, this false image of perfection is not attainable. It's just people get discouraged and people don't want to move up through the chain.
One of the best talks I ever heard from an executive was she was going through her career and she kept talking about the job she applied for and didn't get. Mm-hmm. And it was mind-blowing to me because up until that point in my career, your executive chats were always about, well, I did this and I had experience doing this and I had experience doing this and here I am. It was like they, like you said, the leadership was infallible. There was no job they didn't get and didn't succeed at. So for her to say that after the fact, you would not believe the amount of people that ran up to her and goes, oh, if I did this and this, I could follow your career path.
Yeah. When we have a promotion and it's about time for us to do it again, I'll give a pre kind of, here's how to prepare yourself. And one of the first things I'll say is, I think I've been told no on promotions more times than I've been told yes. And that's just the fact. It's not a career ladder. It's a career jungle gym. And you're going to get knocked down and fall off the slide a few times. The real true test of character and shows your true self is how you get back up and what you learn from that, right? And that's, again, these different messages that we kind of try to scatter throughout the organization.
Do you have a process in place? Because, I mean, the way to do this when it comes to building bridges is consistency. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious about how you go about being consistent.
It's probably more of in my head when any decision is made, one of the first templates I run through is, who are the stakeholders and what order are they told, right? And in general, a very simplistic way is that the employees should always be told first before externally, the community is. Like that, the leadership team meetings I was telling you about, our association, which is some people call them unions, but our association president always has a seat at that table. Any decisions that are made in my head, it's like, okay, these three work groups our stakeholders. So let's communicate with them first before the written memo goes out in email. So if you take that kind of template and you apply it throughout the organization, how any decision is made, it's not perfect, but it does help avoid the situation where people are like, what in the world were they thinking? Or why am I the last one to find out? Right. But again, I think my mind is always trying to search for the next way. And I'll give you another one. I don't know if there's a private sector equivalent, but I like to get in a car and drive around and patrol with the staff and just be out there. It gives me the visualization of what's truly happening, ground truth of what's happening on the street, even down to the equipment. Oh man, this car has the technology sucks or it's broken. Now I understand, right? It's those types of things. So I think the, private sector equivalent could be, just walking the hallways and doing the actual tasks that you're calling your staff to do.
What keeps you up at night when it comes to trying to break those barriers within your own organization? Because it's not always easy. It's a lot of effort. And you're even admitting to the fact that it's not perfect. Come on, it's got to be perfect. Anyway, it's not perfect.
Right.
So what's challenging you?
I am a highly empathetic person. That's my superhero skill, right? Is in a meeting, I can tell if someone is just doing agreeing, disagreeing or whatever. And the natural me wants everyone to buy into whatever the mission is. And I want them to feel great about work. I want them to love being part of the Mountain View PD team. But what keeps me up is the knowledge that not everyone feels that way. And I just, you know, I just know too much about different segments of different work groups or different relational things. And I hear, you know, there's always personnel issues that pop up, or you hear about someone kind of doing something not so wise, you know, it's just those types of things. And you're always just striving to create the best work environment. I want people to have purpose, right? And not just come to work because they're punching a time card. And so these are the things that, you know, when I'm waking up and way too early, or, you know, my mind starts racing, it's things like that.
So my favorite question to always ask when people are going down a path of culture change and trying to reinforce it is, what does success look like for you?
I think when you start seeing people throughout the organization talking and living in themes that are consistent with the culture you're trying to build, right? It's no longer just spouting off the mantra, the mission statement or vision statement, but you see their intentions, their motives are in line with where we're trying to go, right? And we're trying, you know, it's nebulous a little bit, but, you know, I approach this from a policing perspective, right? We have a national crisis where, you know, the narrative of policing and all the bad examples typically come to people's mind first. So I'm really trying to push against that. And, I don't know that it ever ends. I don't know if you're familiar with, you know, like Simon Sinek's Infinite Game, right? We're in an infinite game situation. We are not in a finite game. This police department and myself included will never stand up one day and go, well, we're done. We finished it. We did good. Beat the competition. Not going to happen.
You don't win a relationship. You have to keep building and keep playing the game. No, I'm a big fan of the Simon Sinek. Great book. Well, I have one more question to ask, Chris, which is, what's one simple action people can do right now to improve their relationships at work?
Be vulnerable. You'd be surprised what happens when you drop your guard and you just are vulnerable. And this is right along the lines of Brené Brown's book. But great things happen when you figure out that the person to your right and to your left are struggling just as much as you are, and different levels of communication, closeness, team cohesion. A lot of great stuff comes out of that.
That's Chris Shung. He is the police chief of the Mountain View Police Department and a bit of a communications nerd. Thanks for being here, Chris.
Thanks, Russell. It's been a true honor.